You are listening to the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, episode 264, The Paradox of Virtual Reality. Season 6, episode 264 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is October the 16th, 2016. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and the man who is virtually my brother, James Furlough.
Yeah, so it's a little weird. I cannot see the whites of your eyes right now. It looks like you're wearing a... not sunglasses, not even the Jordy LaForge type of eye gear. It looks like... I'm trying to describe what it would... what would it look like? It's like you have an eraser from a chalkboard plastered over your eyes. And maybe Sony like a bigger than normal eraser.
Sony doesn't want you to call it that. He wants you to call it the future of technology, James.
Oh, you have the future of technology plastered
strapped
across
to
your
my
eyes.
Face. It's true. Yes. This is the... this is the PlayStation 4, and no, the PlayStation
You have the PlayStation
VR.
4 on your face. That's amazing.
And just so people know, it's not a gimmick. We need to specify this. You can go to YouTube and see me do this trick live. People know, well, no, it's not a gimmick. Hold up fingers, and I'll tell you how many fingers you're holding up.
Holding up.
2. 4. 3. 1. No, you're not supposed to go in. Did you go in order there? 4.
Did
no,
I?
You did 2, 4, 3, 1. Yeah, okay, you got it. I was afraid you were like 4, 3, 2, 1. I was like, James, they'll think we're faking. Oh.
No, that's pretty good. So you are seeing. So what is it you're actually seeing right now?
My OS X desktop.
Oh, okay, got it. So you can see the news stories that we're going to talk about, and then you can see just our regular live stream, which is in a separate window with you and me switching back and forth. Is that?
Yeah. It's just like looking at my OS, my Mac Mini.
So, slightly confused. I thought it was a Sony VR.
I know, right?
I feel like we're going to get into this later, but maybe let's just keep going, whatever.
Yeah, no, we'll jump into it right now. So, this is a really cool feature that they didn't tell anybody you could do. They just threw it in there. Basically, what happens when you set it up, you have the PlayStation 4, but you don't plug the headset directly into the PlayStation 4.
Oh.
There is a separate virtual reality processing unit that they have always said it doesn't hold any of, like, it's not like an extra graphics card or anything. It's just for VR stuff. And you take the HDMI output from the PlayStation 4 and plug it into this box. And then the box
takes
all that. Takes data, does stuff in there, and then outputs it to the PSVR headset. The headset sends data back.
So essentially anything that has, if I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly, anything that has an HDMI output will work with your headset.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just a 2D screen, but it's like the equivalent of sitting inside of a movie theater size screen.
So you could, in theory, like, you can hook up an Apple TV or a Chromecast or a DVD player.
In theory, you could. I've done at least one of those three.
Obviously.
And it's like, it's really cool because, like, you can just, I mean, like, anything you can get content from, you just plug it into the player. And the PlayStation has to be on, and the camera has to be on, and everything has to be on, but it can't tell where the HDMI is coming from. So it just...
Wait, so your PlayStation 4 is on right now?
Yes.
And
doing
if you
turn
it off, it would freak out and say, whoop, sorry.
Yeah, it would just tell me, hey, we don't have enough data to be able to...
What? Even though it's not technically connected?
Well, it's doing all the head tracking.
Interesting.
I know, it's really... I have so many wires going all over the place right now on my desktop, James. It's crazy. I got wires coming out of my ears.
Literally. Interesting. Okay. So, I'm probably going to have you for the cover of this episode take a picture of your setup with all the wires so we can get an idea for what the craziness is.
The funniest part about this to me is that in order to drink my coffee, I have to switch it to that the vision of me is large.
Uh-huh.
And I have to, like, look where my hand's going so I can grab the coffee.
That's interesting.
I can't see it, so I can only see the video of it.
Now, does that confuse you because it's like a mirror image, or is it?
Yes.
It's okay.
It's I'm being real careful.
Yes. That's funny. Interesting. But you can hook it up.
Fascinating. I know. Dude, the future is now.
So it's kind of like you could play an Xbox video game.
Oh, yeah. Not just in theory. Very easily. It's like having a monitor. It's just a big old monitor.
And the PlayStation is tracking your head for you. But the input doesn't necessarily have to be meshed up. Like you said, it's just a big screen.
Yeah, for it to be VR, for it to be like the traditional VR where it's you can look around the room, you've got 360 stuff, and it's all like 3D, and you kind of like you can see things in front of you, and they're very like to get that in experience, you need to use the PlayStation.
Totally,
like
makes sense.
I can't get a VR PC. And use the PlayStation with it yet. They say that there's no reason why you couldn't do that. But for just 2D output, just like an extra screen, yeah, it works really good.
So how big does it look right now?
Right now,
if you had a guesstimate.
I'd say, you know how like pre-IMAX screen, like movie theaters?
Wait,
it's big.
Pre-IMAX, that's
like,
what you're saying?
I don't know, I can't see the edges of it I can just see the edges of the screen with my peripheral vision.
Okay.
And I don't have very good peripheral vision. Now there is one downside to it.
Doesn't help, but
I know. I'm just setting expectations.
Well, it was just a weird way you said it. I can barely see the edges and I don't have good peripheral vision. Wait.
That's what you're saying. Yeah, and so the only weird part about it is that the resolution's still pretty low. So it's like the letters, like when if I don't zoom in on articles and stuff, like I can't read it at all.
Oh, okay.
But videos and stuff are fine.
All right. So, interesting. Low res.
You know what, James, though? Interestingly enough, you know what? We're not here to talk about this today. That's actually not true. It's pretty much exactly what we're here to talk about today. Just like
which is what
this week. Well, yeah, this week, like every week, we'll be virtually talking about technology in the virtual continuing opera. Continuing corporate opera. I can do this. I'm so excited. I know, right? And by corporate opera, we, of course, mean the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the VR technology they're developing, the people that are virtually working for them, their VR marketing campaigns, and all the rest. But before we get into the heart of the show, James got a short disclosure he wants to virtually throw your way.
Yeah, I founded and work for a company that is on the sidelines of virtual reality on the HPI. However, I do not represent HP or any of HP's physical opinions. I also own another company, Twitter, which is on the sidelines. Another company, Etsy, which is not doing anything virtual at all. And finally, Lending Club, which may or may not be investing in anything virtual. Probably not.
Probably not.
Because they're all getting VC funding.
Yeah, probably not. If you want to follow us throughout the week, we're up on the we have a digital media footprint. My Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlow. There's a D in the middle there. My Instagram is NextWiggin4, NextWiggin, and then the number 4.
James Furlow at Twitter.com, Facebook, LinkedIn, other places. Technically also, Snapchat, but I haven't actually opened the app since I got a new phone. So you could try it.
I could also not try it and be just as happy. Also, if you want to learn more about the show, everything we talk about this week, all the clicks, links, everything like that, you're going to be at furloughbros.com. You can see videos. You can see the link to the YouTube video, or you can watch me do the show in virtual reality. You can also, we have our Patreon stuff there. So if you'd like to support this show, we'd super appreciate it.
And you're coming up next week to visit. So Yeah. I'm trying to figure out a way to do the show face to, well, you know, as live as it can be.
not virtually. We'll just do it in reality.
Yeah. We'll figure it out.
Unfortunately. It's more fun this way. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Cool. Cool, man. Cool beans.
I like it. So I guess we'll just kick it off. This isn't virtual reality, James, but it's almost as good. Iron Man is going to be the voice of Jarvis.
What does that mean? I feel go ahead.
There's under one condition, which is that Doctor Strange picks a charity for Facebook to donate to. Best part about that entire headline? Entirely accurate. So what's going on?
Yeah, okay, tell me more. That's slightly confusing.
Mark Zuckerberg is a he's obviously the founder of Facebook, but he is what's he doing? What's his deal? He announced earlier this year that he was building his own artificial intelligence to run his house. So if you remember that story, basically he was saying, you know, it's kind of a side project, but he's got a bunch of automated stuff in his house. So he wanted to use the similar tools that that his teams were using for artificial intelligence to automate his house and build his own virtual assistant at home. And we had an update about that a couple of weeks ago where he talked about how cool it was. And he was saying things like, you know, he had like his gait recognizes his face and different types of technologies, but it came out earlier this week that right now it doesn't talk to him. It just sort of shows words and stuff. And he was talking about how it may be time to give his virtual assistant a voice. And he was saying that, you know, he's trying to figure out who to get to the voice of it. And he thought that obviously this is all sort of based around that's not initially true. So some people compare this system to Jarvis, the artificial intelligence that Tony Stark has in the Iron Man comic books and movies. And in the movies, Jarvis is voiced by Paul Bettany, who became what's his name? The Vision. But so the guy was being voiced. Mark was basically like, yeah, he'd be fun, but it seems a little too obvious. I want to go with somebody a little bit, you know, less obvious. Like, I don't know, we could go with Robert Downey Jr., which would be pretty cool.
That's less obvious.
yeah, I know, right? Who is, for those of you who don't know, he's the actor who plays Iron Man, who built Jarvis and uses it. So it kind of is this funny throwaway. Well, Robert Downey Jr. on Facebook responded with saying, I'll do it in a heartbeat if Bettany gets paid and donates it to a cause of Cumberbatch's choosing. That's the right kind of strange. Well, the Doctor Strange.
Bettany?
So Paul Bettany is the voice of Jarvis in the movies. And so he's basically saying, look, I don't want to, like, I don't need the money. Paul Bettany doesn't need the money either. But
anymore.
But they got the new Doctor Strange movie coming out. So Robert Downey Jr. is being a consummate professional and doing a bit of cross promotional business for everybody, making sure that the movie Doctor Strange gets mentioned in a bunch of articles and Paul Bettany gets remembered that he's in those movies and everything. But so it was like, ha ha, funny Tony Stark or Robert Downey Jr. is like, yeah, I'll do it. And then Mark Zuckerberg responded, this just got real. So it sounds like it might be happening. It's kind of fun.
That is kind of fun. Oh, man. That's what the internet enables right there.
Exactly.
Perfect example of, Man, I'm already jealous of his house and I don't know much about it. Good thing I didn't say my goal is to have the smartest house in the world, just the smartest house in the neighborhood. Because I'm pretty certain I'm losing in the world right now.
Yeah, well. But yeah.
That's okay. You okay there? You got this? Focus. I'm going to keep talking so your screen doesn't change. So you have to do it on the little screen. He's trying to drink his coffee right now and just really taking his time.
I could really go for a straw.
Ooh, good call. You and Eleanor alike.
For those of you who aren't watching, my struggle is that the mask is rather large and I can't tip the cup. So I have to tip my entire head in order to get the coffee to come out.
It's kind of like, what was that movie, Roxanne? Where?
Oh, yeah, with the nose.
Steve Martin has a long nose. It's kind of like that.
It's a little bit. So it's just like that, James.
That's pretty cool. I mean, what a crazy little fun pet project, you know?
Yeah.
He's coming to the end of the year, too. Like, I know that that's how he does his stuff, right? He sets a goal for a year, and the next year it's going to be something different. So he's got, someone did the math for me this morning. Thank you for doing it. 10 weeks to Christmas.
Wow.
I know. So
don't tell me that.
That's how I felt about it. It's like, fun fact. I'm like, there's nothing fun about that particular fact unless you are, I don't know, under 16.
Yeah, that's just a horrifying truth about the passage of time.
Yeah, exactly. But anyways, all that to say, he's coming to the end of the year, so he's got to make it work. But it sounds like he's already doing some pretty cool stuff with it, so I won't make too much fun of him for being awesome. That's cool, man. That's cool. So mine is not... Well, mine's pretty awesome. So we've talked a little bit about this in the past, I think. But... we're going to continue on down this path here. So the title of it is How Video Games Are Changing the Way Soccer is Played. And I've talked about it in the context of football before. And with football, the way it was is there came a transition where, and it's like beyond that now, where there was a, and it was right around when I was graduating college, when the number of starting rookies was significantly higher than it had ever been before. And they were trying to figure out why that was. Were they just better athletes? Was it like, did we just have this generation timing where there was kind of a gap and then all of a sudden you got a new crop that comes up? And what they ultimately decided on was that it was right around like my age and maybe just a little bit before that too, was the first crop of people who grew up playing Madden. And what happened was, is because they played video games, specifically like Madden and NCAA football, they were legitimately better players, not just from an athletic standpoint, but from a mental game standpoint. They understood what the entire defense was doing and what the point of certain packages
were. Wow, that's really fascinating.
Seriously, or you're...
No, yeah, that's actually really interesting.
Okay, good. I was like, did I... Couldn't tell from your tone if you're making fun of me or not. But, so as a result of it, they were getting the starting positions, again, not because they could run faster or tackle harder, but because they knew, like, they would see an offense set up, and they had a good idea of what the possible plays were, what was going on. They were just smarter at the game, and so they were starting. And so, pretty interesting, like, phenomenon that is purely enabled by, or like, they give a lot of credence to it, to them playing video games. And then I think we've also talked about how, like, surgeons often, they play video games to keep their, for a slightly different reason, but it's to keep their digits nimble, you know, their thumbs and fingers, because surgery is all about using your fingers very accurately. And so they play video games a lot because it helps them with it. The
interesting
eye finger coordination.
I'm going to say there's two thoughts there that I have. Number one, that's like undeniably true that our generation has that generations before us, their primary dexterity when their fingers were like their pointer fingers, their trigger fingers, and their middle finger. Whereas us, it's our thumb, our most dexterous fingers. Like, we've changed because of video games and game pads. But the other interesting part about that I find is that is that, yeah, just like it changes. If you think about like, what do, when you want to be a pilot, what do? They put you in a simulator and they have you play, yep. They have you fly in a bunch of different places. It's basically like an elective simulator and this hardcore education. Yeah. And they talk about, I remember our father growing up used to talk about all the time how, you know, the people who get to play aren't necessarily just the fastest, strongest. Oftentimes the decision on who gets to play was just who was the smartest, because they learned the entirety of the game. And that was as true for our dad back when he was playing, long before video games, as it is today. And the difference now is that we have these like amazing simulators that everybody gets for Christmas.
Yeah, and I think this will be germane in our very next story, as we're going to talk about how that's going to go up a level with virtual reality. But for right now, there is another sport that they are now saying has significantly impacted by, specifically, FIFA Soccer, which All right. happens to be another EA-owned platform. And so this is the New York Times essentially saying that the sports games have a huge, huge influence on the game. And so they talk about this one guy. His name is... he's a teenage striker, which is crazy. Alex Iobi, he plays for Arsenal. And it's pretty crazy. Like, now... So it used to be... And I don't... It used to be when you played soccer, you would play a team. And it was like random players, random team. Like, you didn't really know who you were going up against. And it was only through the game that you would kind of figure it out and get a feel for who they were, who was really good, who wasn't, that kind of stuff. And now it's like... Before they play, he plays the team on FIFA to learn who the good players are, what their tendencies are, and to get doing his competitive research on FIFA. Which you're like, that's crazy.
That is really crazy.
But they find, like, so FIFA and there's a few other ones. There's Pro Evolution Soccer and Football Manager are the other two ones, but we'll stick with FIFA right now just to keep it simple. Their whole desire is to make the most accurate, lifelike game possible.
And which I don't understand, but I don't understand why that's fun, but that's just me.
that's fair enough. Yeah, well, we played Blitz NFL, which is it's just a different type of style of play, right? Which,
yeah.
You know, you're like 7-on-7, you can tackle anyone anytime, it's all good.
Exactly.
Super fun. But anyways, through their desire to make it as lifelike as possible, they literally hire hundreds of recruiters and statisticians and scouts to go watch the players to figure out how they play so they can integrate it into the game. And they literally were talking about... trying to remember exactly what it was, but there are part of contract negotiations and how good your agent is how good they will do at boosting your stats in some of these games. Cause they track them. That's a point of pride of, oh, you're an 89 for kicking.
That's really funny. Know.
And so they'll talk to him. It's like, hey, how about that 91? Can we crack the 90s? Is that a thing? Which you're just like, wow, it's pretty incredible. And then they'll also say, like, there are certain players who have, sorry, I'm coughing over here, who have signature moves. And so, like, again, this Iwabi was talking about how he has this, he has a soft spot for another player called Aiden McGeady, who altogether, he's like, he's not great, but he has this one turn that he does in the game. He goes, I would go out and practice for hours to try to make, because I saw it on the video game.
That's awesome.
Yeah, pretty fun. And so they're just they're talking about how it's making the games better. So Lionel Messi, who's pretty good, apparently he's a huge soccer. What does he do? He's a PlayStation footballer, is how they've actually described him. As a player, and it's like, no, that's more of an explanation of how he plays. Like, you can do things in the digital pixel world that you then are inspired to go out and try in the real physical world. And so, like, apparently everybody loves, what's his name? Rodolfinho? What's his name? I can't even pronounce it right, because it's
pronounced. I can't help you.
Hold on. It talks about, everyone's going like, it's so easy. Rodolfinho? If I can read it, I have to find it. Oh, here we go. Ronaldinho. Anyways, he's from Barcelona, and Ronaldinho. You can watch videos of him on YouTube. He's phenomenal.
I actually know who that is. I don't know why I was having such a hard time with this. That's
there you go. Yeah, yeah.
Our cousin Mateo. That's his favorite.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's why he's his favorite.
and so, anyways, he does all these tricks that, like, players can do in the game. And he's like, so you love to play him because he can do all these awesome things in the game. But then again, you're inspired to go out and try them in real life. And so it genuinely is making you a better player. And then there's other things that that they talk about where they are they're literally like buying the data. I should say teams are buying the data from like EA companies because they've done all this analytical research, and then they're applying that to their own statistical research of the game for figuring out what players should we buy, what trades should we make, how should we attack this specific type of style of offense and defense. And so it is really like, all right, there are big inroads in the video game world here. Pretty and crazy. And they were talking about how 15 years ago, nobody used data, and now it's just amazing how prevalent it's become. And, yeah, and it's the FIFA guy who's saying, yeah, we'd like to think we played a role in that. She's like, yeah,
I think sure you do.
But man, it's just crazy how these games, a desire to make them lifelike, it just becomes a self-feeding mechanism. And it's almost just as valuable to the players as it is to like EA and those companies now. Just incredible. Right. Pretty awesome.
That is really awesome. I'm impressed by I'm impressed by that. Impressed by these companies. Because it's just, it's funny to kind of follow up on my idea that I remember the day that I realized I don't necessarily like super realistic video games was we were playing one of the Madden football games, and I was just, something happened and it reminded me of actually playing in real life and how annoying and hard it can be. And I was just like, why do I want a realistic video game? Like, next they're going to be having like ad breaks every 30 seconds and just it's going to be a slow and tedious game. But it's amazing how valuable that is. And it's like, you know, if you want to build a super sophisticated simulator for your racing team, it'll, you know, you'll spend tens of millions of dollars developing this software kit that, you know, that the company will just like pay tons for. But when you get millions and millions of people buying it for $60, you can build these ultra realistic simulators. Oh, it's really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, it is super fascinating, and I think the trend is just gonna continue with some of those things. I mean, because it definitely fuels that if you're playing it as a kid, you're gonna want to play it growing up, and you know, do it in real life, and so that continues the sport going. There's some too that just seem to work better in video game format, like basketball for whatever reason, just not as good. Whereas for football seems to work very well, and I think it's just the nature of it or something, you know, because you could have the over the quarterback view. It's very up and down, or you know, one dimensional, if you will.
Yeah.
Whereas soccer's, in my opinion, soccer's not quite as good as a soccer game type of thing, because apparently these guys, they'll play like 5-on-5. And so they're playing with other players in the game, But I'm like, man, if you're not near the ball, you can't see yourself. That's not as fun. It has to do these weird angles, so you can't quite get the same view as you would. I mean, that's the nice part about football. Again, that perspective seems to be pretty well.
I wonder if that helps in soccer, because you have to be so much more cognizant. I wonder if it's just one of those things that you learn how to deal with, or if it actually helps. But it's like you said, because it's all a fixed angle, and for five people in the field, for unless you're the person with the ball, the angle is wrong. You're either out of frame or it's off skew, which requires a whole lot better spatial recognition of where you are, where everybody else in the field is, where you're going. You just have to be much more aware and alert about that, because you're not going to be the center of focus. And I wonder if that's the sort of thing where it kind of focuses. I wonder if it's something that, like I said, you just get over and you deal with it because it's the limitations of the platform. Or if by consequence, when you're playing the game and you're on the other side of the field, you've got this really great sort of bird's eye overview where you're kind of somewhat aware of where everybody is and where everybody's going, even though you're not specifically looking at anybody in particular. It's
probably super valuable, is my guess. Yeah,
I'd say. I'll bet that has the opposite effect of, like, where it annoys us, the casual players. The pro players are like, that's part of the selling point.
Yeah, I wonder how good it is, too, for, like, single-player games, something like tennis. Like, is there a lot of value to that? I don't feel like it as much, because I think there is that... besides the, like, you get to try out new stuff, which I feel like tennis is a little bit more straightforward, but that whole, how do you want to call it, spatial awareness, I think is a huge piece of these games. And like you said, just knowing where you are in relation to everybody else and being able to see it. But yeah, apparently soccer's one of those games that's just doing really well. I think racing is another one, just for whatever reason. It just seems to... And I think that's because you get that first-person view. You can practice going fast without it, you know, in a low-stakes environment, I guess, similar to flying, which is really nice. And we'll actually talk about flying later on in the show and how it can be really dangerous. But anyways, yeah, it's cool. Soccer. Go play it. Get your kids to play it if you want them to be soccer stars. It's a requirement now.
Yeah, well, I have a feeling that if they don't want to play, you know, if they don't want to be playing soccer video games, they don't want to be soccer stars. It's kind of a...
Yeah, that's actually one of the other observations that was made. Like, again, they talked about Lionel Messi. They're like, yeah, he played for 4 hours video game every day. Like, that was what he did. So, yeah, you're talking about a guy who... spent hours on the field playing, went home, played a video game, clearly did not spend enough time doing homework. But, yeah, definitely a sign.
Worked out well for him, I guess. Yeah. So now you know, kids, focus on video games. You don't have to do homework. It's interesting. It's really interesting. Well, you know what, James? You know how you go, you know what's better than a really accurate simulation?
No.
A virtual reality simulation.
Oh. So you got your VR set.
I did.
When did you get it?
I got it on Wednesday.
So 4 days ago?
Wow. Time flies. It's felt like 7 years.
Okay.
In virtual reality, time is slower.
It just slipped on and felt so comfortable to you?
Exactly.
Have you taken them off since Wednesday?
No. Yeah, I have.
Do you sleep with them?
Yeah. But it's funny because it's like, so...
How are you doing right now? We've been talking for half an hour. Are you feeling okay? Like, are you nauseous at all? Or are you like, I could take these off and it would be okay? Or
no, it's actually remarkably comfortable.
Okay.
There's one weird side effect of the PlayStation, and I think it's something they're going to have to fix with a software update. The nose scratching. But for some reason, the screen wanders to the left on me.
What?
And yeah, it just slowly creeps to the left. And so I find myself having to rotate in order to, like, I don't know why it does it. And it's so slow that I can't see it move. I think what's actually happening is it's an artifact of when my head moves.
I was not tracking you perfectly.
Exactly. So, so hopefully it's something that can be fixed in software.
Is that because are you in front of the, like, does your is your physical location matter? Like, are you off to the side of the PlayStation? And so it's, does that matter? Is that a thing? Is there an outside?
It shouldn't, it's sensor? Not supposed to matter. Like, you have to be within the range of what the camera can see for it to do tracking. And honestly, I don't even think it's doing tracking right now because it doesn't have the lights on. I think the headset with its accelerometer and gyroscope are doing all the tracking right now. I think that the camera's only used for like spatial tracking, like with video games. Like when I lean in, the screen doesn't get closer to me. Whereas when I'm playing video games, like if I lean into a monitor, like on my console, like it gets bigger because I'm leaning into it. I can see it closer, which is pretty neat. It makes it seem very much like it's there. So I got one VR game. I got Battlezone VR, which is the classic Battlezone tank game where you're like in a tank, but it's VR'd up. It's pretty pretty spectacular. So it's a lot of fun.
So is it 3D VR? Whoa.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So what are you doing in the game? You're in a tank, you're blowing stuff up, going on missions?
Yes.
All right. Seems pretty straightforward.
It's pretty straightforward. It's pretty good. I got a couple of demo games too, which are fun to play to kind of show it off. And then they have like the PlayStation, they got a couple of different other little things that you can do. And that show off different aspects of the system, which are pretty cool. And then I'm going to get 100-foot robot golf probably today or tomorrow.
100-foot robot golf, huh?
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
I know. I'm really excited. 100
feet's not that far, though.
No. You're not.
Is that the point?
You're not hitting it 100 feet. The robots are 100 feet tall.
Oh. Understand. Got it.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome from everything I've read. So, yeah. But I don't know. It's just,
so do you have hand tracker stuff or what's...
I bought those. Yes. Okay. I actually wasn't going to because I was like, oh, the games I want to play don't require it. But I figured I'm coming out. Like, my hope is to be able to share this with people and have them try it out. Not just you, but anybody who wants to try it out. And so I figure, you know, fullness of experience.
So you have those right now?
I do have them, yeah.
Yes. That means I'll get to try it.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, you should get that robot golf game then.
I know.
I'm assuming it's going to use the hand trackers to hit it.
I don't know.
What?
I don't know. I know.
What?
Lame. I can't help you, James. I don't know. It's the one that's actually been one of the big compliments of this system is that where it is the heaviest of the three major contenders, Oculus, HTC Vive, and Sony, it's the heaviest of the three. It's also the most ergonomic and comfortable.
Huh.
Which...
Yeah, is it's plastic or is it a fabric outside?
It's plastic.
Okay.
My screen's shaking when I tap it.
Does it feel like it's constructed pretty well or are you
kind of
like,
no, it's solid.
I'm going to break it?
No. I've dropped it already once or twice and been like, that's all right.
Fair enough. Yeah. And you have wires coming off of you? It's hard to see.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is the main wire module for everything.
What's that little box thing?
This little box thing is actually the mic and sound controller.
Okay.
Generally speaking, what you do is you plug in to this, and it remixes the sound using their like spatial tracking.
Uh-huh.
So as you move your head, the sound sounds like it's coming from you're in a, from a fixed location.
So can you hook up anything to that? Like, could you hook up?
No.
Okay.
Evidently. I thought that was how it was going to work, but it turns out it doesn't work that way.
Oh, okay.
So, so I was hoping that, like, cause right now my headphones are plugged directly into my Mac. So that is the one limitation of this.
Oh, awesome, so you're wearing thing. Headphones on top of it.
Yes.
That's okay. Got it.
Yeah. So we're figuring out the limitations.
That's okay.
That's exactly. Okay.
And you said the resolution is not that great. Is that just in general as well? Or is it because of the way you have it hooked up right now?
No, it's because of the, the screen is packing as many pixels per inch as they can, but it's a pretty small screen strapped pretty close to your face.
Right.
So they're doing the best they can with it.
Okay.
You know,
so is games, what is that? Is that one? It's that Eve Valkyrie.
Yeah.
This is, I think, the one the show is that eventually going to be available on PlayStation.
It's already available.
Yeah. Oh, you just didn't buy it because you hate.
Yeah.
Them.
Yeah. No, I actually really like the idea of it, but I decided I wanted. I played the demo for Eve Valkyrie, and I played the demo for Battlezone, and they are similar in that you're in a cockpit, traveling around shooting at stuff, and the Battlezone one just seems to be more fun.
Okay.
In short, but I got the demo, so you can try it out.
Ooh, okay, I will.
Yeah,
I will. Interesting. So you haven't felt any sickness at all?
No.
Playing it? No, other than a slight left listing.
Yeah. Okay. I've talked to a couple of people online already, and they talk about some games are better for it than others. This is one thing that I think is absolutely going to happen, though, is that everybody who talks about motion sickness, it reminds me of the people who like were sure that the iPhone was going to fail because nobody wanted a virtual keyboard. Oh. I'm like, I honestly believe that what is going on is that you need a certain level of spatial disassociation. Your brain needs to figure out that when you got something strapped to your head, you're not actually there, and deal with the visual spatial reality differently. And that just takes practice and time. And I think kids who use the headset, I have a feeling that it's going to be one of those things where you're going to find that most people deal with it a-okay, and it'll just kind of go away. Part of it will be designers know what they're doing. Part of it will be the hardware will get better.
Yep.
And part of it will be you just get used to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Your brain figures out that you're not moving, even though it looks like everything's moving, because you've got the thing strapped to your face.
Yeah. Interesting. And you could play, all right. And you could play any video game on it. Right?
Just
like normal. Like it would just look like a big movie screen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of cool. That's actually how I've been playing my PlayStation lately. It's just been sitting here playing.
That's kind of funny. Now, what if you had two headsets? Could you both plug in and play? And I'm thinking like.
No.
Oh, okay.
No. So they have spectator mode, which is so in that little
which process. I got a monitor, so we can do it, and it has an HDMI input.
Nice. So that little processing box, you can plug in an output to it so other people can see what the VR player is seeing, which is cool. So it's like spectators can watch. There are some games where you can actually like play, like I'm pretty sure this is true with 100 Foot Robot Golf, that the second player can play as well as a spectator on the screen. So, you know, it's actually really flexible. It's super impressive how many pixels they're driving, to be honest. But, yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good technology. I like it.
Huh. So what would you say is the killer app for virtual reality?
Oh man, honestly,
because that's the question. What's the thing that's going to make it so that someone like myself goes, you know what? I have to buy this.
I still think the things that are the most impressive come across as demo apps. Because they are like one of the demo apps that they had it's hard to describe exactly, but it's like you're in this little room and it's got like one of those toy like grabber toy machines in virtual reality that you're like controlling with your controller, and then it grabs a trophy and it delivers it to you, and like you hold up your controller and you can move your controller around, and the trophy is in VR above it, and it like looks like it's right in front of you, and then you hit a button and it like gets put on a shelf and becomes like life size, and you like look over and there's just like, oh, there's something there, and oh, there's something there. I don't know, like, it's like, and it's, and I just sit there and I go, like, to me, you're so obviously in the nascent state of all of this. Like, you were so obviously just really at the cusp, and the original iPhone again finds itself as a great example of, number one, there are way too many wires, even for,
really? Okay.
Yeah, even the PlayStation, which has been like, has accolades as being simple, it's not super simple. And that's something that,
because weren't you saying like the instruction videos were seemed overly complicated until you got through them, and then you were like, yeah, oh, this is actually complicated.
Yeah, I could probably, and if I could not have figured it out, I don't think, if I didn't have any directions. I didn't need very much, but man, I could see like even a younger kid who doesn't really know what they're doing, or if you're a parent who's just setting it up for your kid, yeah, it'd be a real pain.
Huh.
If you don't know what you're doing, because there's a ton of different wires going all over the place, and there's like three different HDMI ports on it, so it's like, which one goes where? You know, and why do I have to do this? Like, what? I don't even know. There's USB ports, there's power, there's all sorts of different stuff. But yeah, but the other thing is, just from a software perspective, like, I think the creativity, productivity stuff is going to be huge. I really do. I think that there's, like, when you're in a space where the 3D VR is done very well, and you're very much in that space with this virtual object, it just seems different, and it seems really cool, and it feels like the sort of thing where you can easily imagine, I should be able to do something with this special. And so is there anything like that particularly right now that are going to get everybody to go out and buy it? No, I don't actually think that's true. Like, the games are fun and they're really unique, but especially because, like, so I had to wait in line to pick this up and when I was there, and it was amazing how many people echoed the same sentiment of, like, you know, I don't really know if this, I don't really have anything in particular. This just feels special. I've used it before and it felt different. It felt special. It felt like something cool was going on and I want to be part of it. And yeah, just it's, to me, it's going to be huge. For me specifically, I think a killer app is a full productivity CAD, 3D CAD software package in VR would justify a huge expensive purchase for a company.
And good resolution, right? I mean, is that
honestly critical? Honestly, you just got to know what your limitations are with the resolution.
Okay.
Video looks fine. It's not super HD, but it looks good. It's not that big of a deal. So video games look good. Right. 3D modeling looks good. Text looks good as long as it's a little bit bigger. You know, it's kind of like, it's just, you know,
yeah.
I don't know. It's okay. Like having a little bit of low resolution screen. It's just not the end of the world. We've figured out how to deal with it before. But yeah. Mm. I did pick up this article that I thought was kind of interesting because HTC and Valve kept a relatively low profile this week, and 'cause that's what they do. They actually did make they didn't make an announcement, but word got out they were demoing a new controller mechanism. So they've got their cool spatial trackers that they've had for a long time. They were demoing their next generation one, which actually straps to your wrist so you can release your hand from the controller.
Nice.
So you get a little more articulation with your fingers and stuff. But Oculus, they really made sure everybody knew they were still around this week. They were going way out of their way as Sony was launching their system. So the Oculus CEO, Brendan Iribe, had a talk with The Verge, and he made seven statements, some of them more interesting than others about virtual reality, but I don't know, I thought it was kind of good. I want to go through it really quick.
Yeah.
So The first one, he said, most Rift and general VR experiences won't be room scale. And we've talked about HTC Vive.
And room scale again is...
is you can stand up and walk around inside of a large area, and they'll do motion tracking throughout all of that. PlayStation VR and up to this point, the Rift have been seated experiences, which are you when you lean forward and you lean backwards and you look around, you do all like you get all those different perception changes the way you'd expect to it.
Yeah,
but you can't
would that be
walk in
seat scale.
What?
Seat scale?
Yeah, a seated experience. But the walking around ones, it just requires more space in your room. Like, I wouldn't necessarily want it just for that reason. Like, I don't have enough room for the big ones. So even if I had the Vive, most of the software I'd be looking at were seated experiences ones, yeah, or standing experiences, not I don't necessarily have to be seated, but the idea of I don't want to have to walk 10 feet because I don't have 10 feet to walk around.
Right.
And
the Omniball experience. Oh, man.
Exactly. So I tend to agree with him on that one, that definitely if you're just from the constraints of where you set this up, that will be a limitation for a while until houses are just generally made with VR rooms built into them, which, you know, who knows how long it'll take.
Just an empty room. What's in here? VR. Whatever. Yeah,
everything.
You want.
Exactly. So I don't know. Especially now that I have my own virtual reality headset, James, I can speak authoritatively on this. But yeah, I think there's a lot you can do from a software perspective to take advantage of VR and have people be seated. And then
I know there's a lot of people who are like, there's no fun in walking. Just teleport me there. Get it done.
Yeah, there's a bit of that too. There is something to be said to be able to, especially for like real life scale creation, whether you're, you know, to have, and that's my thing, is it's like what I want is I want the HTC Vive so that it's large and I've got this entire room that I can walk around in, and then I want the software to not force me to walk around in it unless I opt for it, you know? And so they're figuring out the balance there. And Oculus, they didn't design their system that way originally, so it's a little more expensive and it's a little more janky to do it. And so they're obviously going to lean on that's not the sort of experiences we're going for. But I don't think that that's crazy. I do acknowledge the fact that HTC Vive, you can do on the Vive anything you can do on Oculus or PlayStation. Whereas that's not, the reciprocal isn't true.
Gotcha.
Then he said all-in-one headsets won't replace PC or mobile VR. So this is kind of interesting because that's one of the big things they announced last week was an all-in-one headset, something that had more horsepower, more dedicated hardware than a mobile phone strapped to your face, but obviously not as much as a full-blown wired PC. And so they're kind of like, well, but why would you do that then? Why are you building that? And Oculus is their argument, I think, makes sense. They're basically saying, look, we think that there are opportunities for all three. Having a phone with you all the time, like Google's Daydream VR or the Gear VR experiences, like it makes sense to have those as a very low cost entry to the market. It also, the nice part about a super powerful computer is that you can do things that you can't do with the other ones because you have fewer computational restraints. and yet, dedicated hardware can give you advantages over like mobile hardware, including and yet also be mobile. So I don't know. It's one of those ones where you're like, yeah, they're just kind of spreading the gamut. I think that there will be one of those three will be the clear leader or winner, you know, in 10 years, one of them will be overwhelmingly the the direction everybody goes. But I, you know,
you're gonna, I predict you're gonna see the mobile VR go away and be replaced by mobile AR, which has a screen darkening mode.
Yeah.
Turn it into VR. I mean, that's what you're gonna have.
You know what? That's fair. That is a fair assessment.
It's funny how he talks about how they're always gonna have the PC VR market, because he makes the statement that, you know, there's no substituting or competing against a powered, plugged-in GPU and CPU.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like my phone is just as powerful as PCs were 10 years ago. But, okay.
Well, it's one of those things where when you're chasing the bleeding edge, it's nice to have the bleeding edge. And that's where they're saying is that, and because it goes back to that idea that VR isn't, you know, when we first started talking about VR, the nice part about VR is that it was the last medium. And that's not to say that there aren't other mediums. It's just that theoretically in virtual reality, you can simulate any other medium. So, you know, it's like, originally we had books, then we had, you know, music and movies and all these different mediums. VR is a medium. It's not an end goal product in and of itself. It's like now I'm using it as a large virtual monitor. That will always have a place. And so the question, so it's sort of a weird, like, it's a weird way to think about it, because basically what he's saying is there will always be a bleeding edge for using, there will always be the most high-tech use cases for full-powered PCs. There's always going to be a use case for that. Therefore, VR will always have a use case attached to it. But you're like, well, yeah, that seems obviously true. it's just a different type of screen to some degree. It's a 3D screen that wraps around your entire face. That's pretty neat. And he actually went on to say the Rift is still best with the high-end PCs. Again, it's like,
yes.
How is that not odd? Like, some of these things, like I said, some of these things are interesting takes. That one in particular isn't. This is something that I think is really interesting and good for people to hear. It's a new Rift probably isn't coming for, quote, a few years. This idea that they don't, and everybody who's in this market right now is making the same statements. We'll see if it's true or not. But whether it's HTC or Oculus or Sony, they're all saying, look, we're not going to update this hardware for a couple of years. We're not
going to make a video game system. Interesting.
Exactly. We're not going to chase. We're not going to go with the iPhone and the smartphone model where we update it every year, where we do iterative improvements every year and try to get you to upgrade to the newest one, which I think makes sense when you think about like the difference between the smartphone market and the tablet market, for example, is the iPhone or the iPhone market. The smartphone market has subsidies. They are attached to your phone bill. So the upgrading is more frequent and iterative improvements make sense because the competition's a little bit different, whereas giant, huge changes to tablets don't drive sales the same way. And really, at this point, what you want, I think, more than anything as a developer is to say, the user base is going to grow slowly, but it's going to be around for a long time. So if we develop software now, when there's no user base, as the user base grows, what we developed will still make sense, still work on this platform. And as a buyer, as a consumer, you can buy it knowing that it's still going to be supported by developers and by the Oculus or HTC or whatever for quite a few years, which is cool. It's good to hear. And I don't know. It just makes investing easier. I don't think that that's going to be the case forever. I think that you'll see as the market matures, as there's proof that there is a market, in within a couple of years, you'll see more and more iterative improvements coming along, especially if things ever standardize, where the, you know, because right now you need all these different components working in concert, whether it's the, you know, whether it's the camera, the headset, the hand, the controllers, mm-hmm. the PlayStation. You need an entire set of different equipment to go together. But if you can ever get to the point where it is treated a little bit more like a monitor, and it's not, it can work on anything, as it were. I think you'll see more companies get into the game, and you'll see over time there will be consistent iterative improvements.
I especially think about like the mobile VR stuff. That's going to continue to incrementally improve every year.
Yeah,
just because the phones will be interesting.
This is bad news for us. Oculus is staying with the position that Mac users probably won't want a Rift. Yeah, but what about the most popular of laptops, Apple's MacBook line? When you think about laptop owners, especially MacBook owners, I do think that class of customers is probably going to be better served by the standalone category. Just the nature of Apple users, they have these single products that they use. I think they're less likely to be tethering their VR headsets to their laptop, and they're more likely to just have this all-in-one headset you can put on and it just works, which is a really nice way to say exactly what Palmer Luckey said, which in his curt fashion, which is basically, if they ever build a powerful computer powerful enough to support it, sure, we'll launch it there.
I think he's saying the nature of those people is they want something that just kind of works and isn't all in. They're not want to deal with all the wires and all the hackery there's some truth to that.
I think you could get away with one cable. I think Mac users would be willing to do that. If you could get
USB-C.
Man, you need so much more data availability. And that's the problem, right? Is that these things require HDMI just to get enough data going across just to power the screens, much less everything else that's required. USB-C just wouldn't cut it. But I think that, like I said, I think that there is definitely a space for it to work in Apple's ecosystem, and there's definitely a space for innovators to come along and do specifically that, but it's got to be a single cable. it's got to be like a monitor, one cable, plug it in and it works.
Makes sense.
Yeah, he said all-in-one headsets will make backpack PCs passe. Right now there's
future tense.
I know, right? There's a couple of different companies that are making all-in-one backpacks, HP amongst them.
Really?
Basically, and for those of you who don't know what this is, it's literally like it sounds like. It's a PC that has straps you can put under your back, and you plug your VR headset into it, so you're not tethered by wires.
That's
it's
janky.
It's a really expensive, inconvenient hack.
All-in-one.
All-in-one headset is going to be able to do 90% of that. The one thing that I really am actually very interested to see if when this comes around, but low latency wireless transmission of images. That is something that has been something of a holy grail for quite a few companies trying to figure out how to do that. But I got to believe that if that is a problem that can be cracked, it'll be cracked by people trying to make wireless VR headsets, because that would be so great if you could have low latency images being pushed to the headsets from a super powerful PC, no wires attached. But nobody's talking about that right now. And then he also said, James, you're wrong. Specifically, I believe he said that on stage. Said augmented and virtual reality won't merge for now.
Well, for now,
I know it might be augmented virtual reality. Yeah, I know it might be augmented virtual reality where you put on this Rift, this pair of VR goggles, and you can actually see the real world just the way it is here. But it is all rendered in 3D. We definitely don't look the way we do right now in real life. We look like 3D characters, or we'll look like some kind of depth map of dots. We'll look good, but not at this resolution. You can very quickly tell if something is real or not in AR. I think it'll look good. I think whether it's HoloLens or somebody else, I think they can make an object look good, but you'll be able to tell it's not real. So basically what he's making
the
argument
is...
Does it
have to look real?
Yeah, no. I don't... You know what the thing is that it's like, there's this big question of, are you developing a bunch of technology for the wrong thing? Are you going the wrong direction? Are you going to spend billions of dollars building out this ecosystem of technology that's going to be surpassed and beat by AR within the decade?
And he thinks
And he obviously thinks no, and he wants his investors to think no, and he wants his customers to think no, and he wants his developers to think no. And so he's going to come just hardcore and say, well, yeah, maybe, I mean, it might be that, but I think there are real, like, deficiencies with the AR. And you're like, yeah, but...
You got to understand, AR, there's, from a hardware perspective, there's a huge crossover, right? You want a high definition screen that looks good. You want head tracking. You want room scale tracking. You want to know your location. You're going to be hooked up to the internet and be streaming information. You're going to want to have good sound. You're going to want to have a good microphone, some good sort of input system. These are all things that are going to be true for both of them. You want it to be lightweight. You want it to be all in one. You want it to have good battery life. Those are all the same. And then one of them, you're strapping a camera on the outside of it, or you're throwing on some sort of OLED type of lens so you can see the outside and it's a transparency or not or something. I'm not saying that in 2 years AR is going to overtake virtual reality. I think virtual reality is an easy one. There's an obvious market with the gamers. I think that's the extent of it. and they're going to find people are probably not going to go out and buy an Oculus to watch movies.
Well, it's
probably not going to happen.
Yeah, I would agree. And this is the thing that I think you're going to find is that, Oculus is going to be a hit with gamers. It's an easy in yep. there. It's going to be a hit with anything where you need to view anything where there's an advantage in viewing something at scale before you make it in reality, whether it's building a plant, designing a model for a movie, 3D graphics, whatever, all sorts of industrial creative arts type applications. It'll have a lot of use there. But like you said, yeah, I think we'll still, especially because the large TV screens are so friggin' cheap. We'll keep going that way for a long time.
What, you're going to buy one for your whole family? This is the problem that 3D TVs had, where we're not all going to sit here. I don't know. It's just going to run into certain issues, I guess, because they're not cheap enough yet. And maybe the price is going to come down dramatically, in which case, yeah, sure, everyone can have a VR headset.
Well, yeah.
I don't know if I can put a timeline on it, but I feel like in the next 10 years, AR is going to be a bigger market than VR.
Well, and I think the big thing for me when it comes with a statement like that, and one of the reasons why it's easy for me to agree, is because it's so obvious that Apple isn't going to build an AR headset. They're going to build an AR platform where there is extra information about, you've got a phone that has a camera on it. The camera is being projected onto the screen. And there's all sorts of supplemental information being added to that screen. So even though it's not strapped to your face, you're still be getting an augmented reality through that screen, which is one of the first things that was ever really in your early generations of the iPhone. And I think it was iOS 3 when they introduced the gyroscope.
Yeah, the gyroscope.
That was the first suite of apps. Everybody was like, we can do VR now or AR now. That was when we first heard that term.
Jenga.
Exactly. Even before Palmer Luckey was out doing his Oculus thing, that was when we learned about AR, was in those early nascent times. And I think that that's still the dream at Apple. I think it has a lot of... that's a very credible direction to go. Apple's going to show, hey, this is a useful way to build out that platform, and it's going to take the legs out from the AR headsets for a while, because everybody's going to be like, why do I need a headset? I can just do it on my phone. Whereas VR really only makes sense as a headset, because it's, you know, you're completely replacing reality. You're blocking your vision. You can't see the rest of the world. It's not just supplemental information. I think that they're going to have these convergent, divergent evolutions, and we'll just watch them weave back and forth over the next couple of decades.
Yeah, I still think you'll have your VR headset that sits at home that you use, or in your cube. It's in a singular place, and it doesn't go with you anywhere. But then you'll also have an AR or something that you're wearing with the majority of the time. I still think Google Glass is right. And I think they had obvious branding problems and whatever, but I don't know. And don't get me wrong, I'm fully enjoying this VR process, and someday we'll probably have one, to my wife's chagrin, but... Which is the other one? I don't know. We'll see. I'm actually really curious to see how she reacts over next weekend. Because I remember when I first told her about the Nintendo Wii, she was like, that's the dumbest thing ever. Why would I be into that? And I was like, because it's awesome? And she was totally against it until we played with it. And then she was like, when are we getting one? I was like, yes! Yeah. So I'm going to be interested, because she's very much in the camp.
Doing my best to evaluate each experience that I have with the PlayStation, cataloging ones that I think will be really easy for Jesse to wrap her head around.
Yes.
And because it's like, or not, it's not necessarily the right way to put it, but things that will be really impressive to her really quickly. Those are the sorts of experiences I'm thinking, which is why I'm gonna tend us away from Battlezone, because I think you and I will enjoy it a lot, but I don't think Jesse will quite as much.
Yeah, that's fair.
Of course,
golf game.
And say, of course, there is something to be said of like when the you know what? I'm not going to ruin it for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's cool. Cool, interesting article. Interesting. I know where we're going. I've seen the future, and it's a box on my face.
Yes, you and Neo and Trinity and Morpheus. It's gonna be good. Sweet. Well, did you know that computers are setting us up for disaster? We're kind of switching to automation topic.
Yeah,
it's actually this interesting story by The Guardian. It was talking about an airplane crash, actually, and how this one pilot, his name was Mark DeBowie, he walked into the cockpit of his own airplane, and they call it aeroplane, which I find fascinating. But anyways, he was confronted with a scene of confusion. The plane was shaking violently, and so violently that it was hard to read the instrumentation, and there was an alarm that was telling him that the plane had stalled. But his co-pilot was trying to figure, you know, like, looked disheveled. and he asked his co-pilot, he goes in a calm tone, what's happening? And his co-pilot, in a less calm tone, says, we completely lost control of the airplane, and we don't understand anything. We've tried everything.
That is not the sort of thing you want to hear from your co-pilot.
Yes. It turns out that the crew was, in fact, in control of the aeroplane. And there was one simple course of action that could have ended the crisis that they were facing, but they hadn't tried it. And which is like, and this is all through black box, right?
Gonna guess, turn it on and off again?
No.
Okay.
So what happened was that they were flying potentially like, or not potentially, they were flying one of the most advanced airplanes in the world, an Airbus 330. It's legendarily smooth, and it uses some of the most sophisticated automation called fly-by-wire. Mm-hmm. And so traditional aeroplanes, give the pilots direct control of the flaps of its rudder, the elevators, and aileron. However, fly-by-wire is it's essentially computer driven. And so what it does is it takes your input that you give it and then interprets what it is that you wanted it to do and then makes the plane do it smoothly. So you, if you were to like press, like pull up on the rudder real fast to make the plane go up, right? Pull up back on it to make it go up. It wouldn't just jerkily go up. It would smoothly rotate it so the plane started to go up. And same with right, left corrections and things like that. So it makes you seem like It says it turns clumsy movement into graceful ones, which is pretty cool, right? And so that's one of the things where they're saying it makes it very hard to crash an A330,
which is ideal.
Yes, which is they had zero crashes in the first 15 years after it was introduced in 1994. Okay.
Okay.
But they said that there's a risk to building a plane that protects pilots so assiduously from even the tiniest errors. It means that when something challenging does occur, the pilots have very little experience to draw on as they meet that challenge. And so I think you can see where this parallel is coming pretty quick here. So it turned out that there were some thunderstorms and the senior pilot had only slept for like an hour the night before because he was out partying with the stewardess, apparently. Yeah, it happens in Rio. So anyways, he was off taking a nap. The co-pilot did not like the fact that they were flying too low. So he wanted to climb the plane up to 36,000 feet, but because of Air France regulations, they make him fly lower, conserves fuel and all sorts of stuff. So it put him essentially through the storm. And what happened was going through the storm, ice crystals began to form on the wings, which is usually not a big deal. They switched on the anti-icing system to prevent too much ice buildup. But what happens was it did, like, one of the airspeed sensors on a plane actually did ice over and stop functioning, which isn't a big deal, but it requires the pilot take control. Okay?
Okay.
But something else happened at the same time, and for the same reason, the fly-by-wire system downgraded itself to a mode that gave the pilot less help and more latitude to control the plane. Okay? So all of a sudden, like I was talking about your jerky movements, it smooths it out and helps you do it. It essentially stops doing that. If you gave it jerky movement, the plane was jerky.
Okay.
Yeah. So they said the first consequence was also immediate. The plane began rocking left and right, and he overcorrected with like sharp jerks on the stick. And then he made a simple mistake. He pulled back on his control stick, and the plane started to climb steeply. Oops. So, and again, normally the plane wouldn't even let him do it, but because this one sensor had frozen over, it kicked it over to a more manual mode. It let him do it. So the automated voice started barking out in English, stall, stall, stall. Actually, I spoke French, but whatever. Despite the warning, he kept pulling back on the stick, and what he was looking at were black skies above the Atlantic and not actually looking at the Atlantic. And he was climbing at a rate of 7,000 feet a minute, which is a lot. Okay. But the problem was that their airspeeds had evaporated, because that's kind of how it works, right? If you go up too fast, the plane slows down, right? So they began to slide down through the storm towards the water that was 37,500 feet below. Now, to fix the plane would have been really easy. Point the stick back down, turn the nose down, let it build up speed so the wings like do their thing again, and then level out and go back up to the level that you wanted. That's the fix.
So wings start doing their thing. You mean flying?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes, exactly. So the article is saying that the source of the problem was that the system had did so much that it kept the plane safe for the last 15 years across millions of miles, specifically talking about that fly-by-wire, that the problem was that the pilots had grown up to rely on it. So they say the pilot was probably suffering from something called confusion mode. Like, he may not realize that the plane had switched to the alternate mode and was providing him a lot less assistance and was letting him get away with stuff that he normally shouldn't have gotten away with. And then they say, but perhaps he knew that it had switched, but did not fully understand the implications. Like, the plane would now allow him to stall it out.
Right.
And so the other thing was just his lack of experience, and it, which they, like, you would think he's been flying for a while, but he had spent a lot of hours in it, but those hours had been spent monitoring and adjusting the plane's computers rather than flying directly. And the tiny number of hours that he had spent manually flying, almost all of them were takeoff and landing. And so this one author in Vanity Fair said that they were hideously incompetent. And he's not disagreeing. He's like, yeah, actually they were. And it's like this weird thing of the problem is it's called the paradox of automation. Okay, so you lock that one away. That's going to be a fun word to use a lot in the next coming decades. And they say like this applies for operators of nuclear power, cruise ships, the simple fact that you can no longer remember phone numbers because they're all stored. And why a lot of us now struggle with mental arithmetic because we have electronic calculators. Essentially, it is the better the automatic systems, the more out of practice human operators will be, and the more extreme the situations they will have to face. And what's interesting about them is that I think this is a good quote. It says, manual control is a highly skilled activity, and a skill needs to be practiced continuously in order to maintain them. Makes sense, right? Yet, an automatic control system that fails only rarely denies the operators the opportunity for practicing these basic controls. When manual takeover is necessary, something has usually gone wrong. And that means that operators need to be more rather than less skilled in order to cope with these atypical conditions. So that's the paradox, is because of automation, the only time you're going to actually need to do it, you have to be more skilled. But because of automation, you practice less and are indeed less skilled.
I'm having some fat deja vu right now. Have we talked about this before?
Probably in a different context.
Okay. I had this conversation with my girlfriend when we went to the wedding in New Mexico last weekend, and we actually talked a long time about this particular idea, and I brought up specifically plane pilots and this idea that the more automated it is, the more dangerous things become. And I was bringing it up in the context of the difference between Google's self-driving cars and Tesla's autopilot, because maybe this was the different context, because we talked about it back. Google said, look, we think it's dangerous and reckless to introduce semi-autonomous cars that require the drivers to be able to pick back up, for the exact reason that you're talking about. And Tesla responded, Elon Musk responded, saying, autopilot on our cars can and already does save lives. And so we have a moral obligation to put it out there, even if it's not perfect.
Yep.
Because it will improve lives. The consequence being what you just said, there's the paradox of automation, that the more automated it is, the more you need automation. And when the automation kicks off, it's because things have come really far off the rails. And so effectively how you would draw the analogy to self-driving cars would be pretty similar, that the car will be driving itself and will always drive itself. It will only kick over to you needed to drive it when some situation has gotten really bad. Like, for some reason, its vision is occluded. There's snow. there's bad weather. So it's like the time when your skill needs to be at its highest is the only time that you ever exercise that skill, and you exercise it rarely. And this goes back to the doctors thing that you're talking about earlier. Why do they play video games? To keep their fingers nimble, to keep practicing, because it's only in the extreme situations anymore that the skill's needed, and it's the last thing you've done.
Not totally. And this this story has, I mean, it's a bad ending where they say that the captain, once he got up, it was a minute 38 seconds after the airspeed indicator had failed. It was still 35,000 feet, though it was falling at 150 feet a second. But by then, the de-icers had actually done their job, and the airspeed sensor was operating again. But the co-pilot no longer trusted any of the instruments. So the plane was now in perfect working order and was telling them that they were barely moving forward at all. But he didn't trust it. And so they say that they appeared to assume that yet more of their instruments had actually broken. And they said that the captain, he was silent for 23 seconds, which is a long time, was long enough for the plane to fall 4,000 feet, which is just like, it's incredible. And I think what they say is at 11:13 p.m., 40 seconds, less than 12 minutes after he had first left the cockpit for a nap, 2 minutes after the autopilot switched itself off, the co-pilot yelled, "Climb, climb, climb," and then the co-pilot said he had to stick back the entire time, but for whatever reason, the captain was kind of like shell-shocked, and it said, "Finally," he said, no, don't climb, and he takes control of the plane, and he finally figures it out, right? It's like, oh, this is what's going on. We need to push the nose of the plane down and begin to accelerate fast. But he figured it out at 11,000 feet, which just is simply not enough room for the plane. And so they started to regain speed, and they hit the Atlantic at about 125 miles an hour.
Holy cow.
And everyone died instantly as a result of it. Pretty crazy. Like, I don't know, big implications. And I think this is the reason, like you said, why Google is saying like, no, we want fully autonomous. You never have to touch it, because they're talking about this automation paradox. And, you know, obviously, Tesla's sitting in a different camp.
And the tough part is, the automation paradox is that the fly-by-wire, not only is it a more comfortable flight, but it is a safer flight.
Yeah.
You know, it's when things go wrong. Like the implication, you know, like let's say the pilot had been flying. It's not like that sensor wouldn't have gone bad. It's not like they wouldn't have had problems. Maybe it would have been easy to deal with, but for a pilot that was flying all the time, but that's not necessarily true. You're still talking about failed sensors. At this point, it's just one of those things where the programmer said, look, there are too many options for why this sensor can fail, and therefore, like, it could have just been a natural failure, in which case, or a complete failure, I should say, in which case, yeah, the last thing you want to do is have the computer be basing all of its movements off of this complete failure. And I think what we're going to find is the answer is going to be, is actually going to be moving away from co-pilots and pilots that can take over. Because at this point, by and large, they oftentimes just act as makes you feel good as a passenger, even though they do barely any of the flying.
I think there's value in having someone else with you.
Yeah.
When you're talking about 300 plus lives, at least someone else where you can go, wait, what are we doing? Did you fly
right? Well, what they've become is they've become technical operators.
Yes.
Like highly skilled technical operators, but the idea that they would ever be allowed to fly the plane is like, it's becoming more and more a, that I think the direction... Just
maybe the airline companies have a recognition that this is a problem, and we need to at least get them in the simulators or have them practice something. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just like, you got to have some sort of... Have that be part of your annual license renewal. We put you through some sort of test. And it's not maybe not even a test, just a training thing, right? Like, don't...
You know what the weirdest part about fly-by-the-wire is?
What?
Like, the whole idea of fly-by-the-wire, it's basically powered steering.
Yeah.
It used to be that there was a physical tether between the control stick and the flaps. There, you moved, and it pulled, like, tethers, and the flaps moved. But now it's you move the joystick, and a computer interprets those movements and runs motors that move the flaps. And so it's not...
Yeah, they're talking about, like, electrical wires.
Exactly. And so what's interesting about that is, why couldn't you just say, look, your job is to fly the plane, and since you're not actually flying the plane while you're flying the plane... Here's a VR headset and just plug into the fly-by-wire system. We'll keep you away from the rest of the plane, and you're going to simulate different flying conditions, because there's absolutely no reason why. Yeah. I'm blowing your mind now. You could just do that in the plane.
Oh my gosh. That hurts my head.
So they're just practicing while they're quote unquote operating the plane.
The plane's doing its own thing, and essentially you turn the cockpit off and turn it into a big simulator.
Yep.
Because you got another computer running somewhere else actually flying the plane.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's crazy. And then you don't have to... Wow. Fascinating.
I have a feeling we're a long ways from them actually doing that, but something along those lines, it's not ridiculous by any means.
It's not ridiculous. It's a little ridiculous.
Yeah, okay. I
get it. Why not? If you're on a longer flight and you know you got an hour to kill, why not?
Yeah. Well, and I think the really big takeaway here is, you know,
and you can set it up where all you're doing is you're undoing the like all the dials and everything. You don't have to mess with those. You just like
right.
controls themselves.
Yeah. Huh. And to me, the big question
that's insane.
I say and to me, the other big part of this that's interesting is that, the reason it's more widely applicable is because obviously in airplanes, that's your job. Like, we don't feel bad having the airline say, no, it's your job to know how to fly the plane. So you have to practice, you have to go in a simulator.
Well, and the nice part about it, like with these guys, like in theory, they had plenty of time to figured out. I mean, the guy was napping, woke up, went, oh, what's going on? You know what I mean? Like, when you're 37,000 feet in the air, like, you have time to figure it out. So you could be doing a VR thing. Alarm goes off. Auto shuts all that down. So you're not distracted anymore and go, okay, reorient ourselves. What's going on?
Right. Well, what I was going to say is where this gets more complicated is driving.
Because yeah, we just don't have that kind of time.
It's not our job to drive. Yeah, are we going to have to do simulator hours every year so that we can keep our driver's license? Or are we just going to get to the point where we won't? Well, and that's the answer, actually, is yes, you'll have to keep driving. Then driving licensing tests will become more difficult. Because in order to be a driver, and then the cars just completely take over. But that's not just like cars and planes are where it's easy. There's all sorts of other places just in our jobs as they get more automated where... It's when things go wrong that becomes, it's really difficult to, or go unexpected. It automates in a way that we, the users, don't expect because, and another great example of where this is going to get super weird is with artificial intelligence, because how often do they talk about how the AI finds solutions that are way more efficient or way more, you know, well-designed and... People are like people never knew, and the simplest example of this is in Super Mario. Turns out that, like, generally speaking, you have to kill the enemies by jumping on them from above, and then you jump off. Well, it turns out that there is, because of how the game is designed, you can actually come up from underneath, and if you jump at the right moment, it kills the enemy. And so it's this attack vector that's really, really hard for people to do. But the AI can do it because it's perfect. And it figured out that you can do it through trial and error. It mastered that technique, and it's one of the techniques that the AI use. And there's all sorts of examples of that that we're going to find where computers are going to do things that humans would never do. And we're just going to sit back and be like, is it supposed to do that? And should I take over? Should I not take over? I don't really know the answer to this question.
Well, we had a situation at work where we were asked to implement this change, and we kind of had a rough idea for what the impact on it from a dollar standpoint would be on the change. And I ran it through the system, and it came up pretty close to what we expected it to be. We're like, okay, cool, sweet, you know, what we thought. And then they had another update, and they're like, oh, we found an error, we fixed it, run this new thing through it. So I ran it through, and I got results back, and it was way higher than what we were thinking. And I was like, huh, that's weird. But it was having that recognition.
That intuition.
Yeah, that, like, this doesn't look right. And started going back through looking at it. Well, it turns out that when we did it the first time, some of the data we had input ourselves, there was an error in a totally different part of the system. So we've got different printers, essentially, and we were focused on a single printer doing this. Well, it turned out that there was a whole other printer, a totally different model, totally different size, all that stuff, where we had introduced an error to it. And it was an error had been introduced that just so happened when you combined. So what they originally had given us was supposed to be a much bigger change than what it had calculated out to be. Because they themselves had an error, but it turns out that we also had an error, which offset almost perfectly their error. Total coincidence. It shouldn't have done it at all. And so when I did it the first time, everything looked fine. I was like, oh, cool. Landed right where we thought it would be. And then when they fixed their problem, that's when all of a sudden it became very obvious to us of, oh, wait a second, we have a problem. And it's this weird situation where part of it's we're not manually inputting at all. They're all in these spreadsheets and in one sense automated. And you just, when you have 150 different line items, that's how many we break them into, and you've got them for every quarter going back since 2006, you just tend to not look at all of them individually. And so there was this weird, like, recognition of, like, there's this error that sat out there that we didn't find very fast and essentially ended up taking a bajillion dollars out of the plan once we recognized the error. And again, it was one of those where had we discovered it earlier, we probably would have done something, would have changed something. But because of the automation, we didn't catch it until it was way too late. And we just essentially were like, well, I guess we got to take some dollars out of this plan. All right.
Well, it's a...
I'm trying to be general.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a similar issue this week. I was dealing with wrote an algorithm that was doing some really kind of complicated geometric math and finding shapes and stuff that needed to be made. And it was a similar situation where it was working really well. Then I put in this different... I actually expanded it to do like a whole suite of different shapes at the same time. And that's when it became really obvious that something was terribly wrong, that was skewing everything at a weird angle. And it turns out that everything I had been doing up to that point had been a series of magic numbers. They were actually eigenvalues, I realized later. So I had designed the entire thing around this perfect axis that if I picked numbers that were along this axis, it would work perfectly. And as soon as you got off side of the axis, you'd get all these weird skewing factors going on. And I was just picking magic numbers the whole time when I was testing it originally until they all looked perfect. And then it was until I actually got done that I was like, and did it with the wider sweep of numbers that I was like, oh wait. And that's a very simple mathematic geometric explanation of exactly what you're saying. And if you don't have that intuition yep. to recognize that something's wrong, and that goes back to like, you know, it's I
for
don't,
some things not a big deal, but man, when you're talking like flying planes or driving cars, like that, and there's a time element to it as well.
Yeah,
like that's where it becomes a problem.
Yeah,
and there's no good solution.
It reminds me of the quote that our grandfather had taped above his super old original Macintosh 2 that said, "To err is human. To really foul things up requires a computer."
Yes! Oh, man. That's...
I know.
That hits home right there.
And it's funny, I remember reading that when I was like 10, and that has stuck with me ever since, because I didn't understand it back then.
How things up requires a computer.
Say.
That's the quote right there.
I know. It's funny, I remember reading it when I was 10 and not understanding it, and nowadays I'm just like, that is more true than it's ever been. yeah. Interesting. So, how much time do we got?
Not enough. 20 minutes.
Oh geez. Okay, well I'm gonna combine these two into a real quick story then. I'm sorry. Rid of the story, I just combine them into one. So we're gonna talk social networks for a second. Apple built the super successful social network.
Ping?
No. They did it completely on accident. And it's this amazing tool that keeps people in their operating system because it's a hardware bound social network. It's iMessages.
iMessages.
And we've kind of talked about this before, but I've actually been reading a couple of arguments where people, that's just what they look at it as.
Yeah.
Like this idea that, you know, messaging is the next stage of social networks, and Google wants their thing and Facebook wants their thing, but really looking at it as the network effect and social network. And there are quite a few iPhone users who would consider moving over to Android, but don't, because they lose their social network. And this is a pretty good article. It talks about the bias against people, though. Yeah, but the green bubble, man. The green bubble versus green the blue bubble.
I hate green bubbles.
I know. Well, you know,
that's okay. Like Jesse, she texts her parents and she goes, "Hey, can I add you to the thread?" I was like, "There's green bubbles involved. Sorry." If they're all blue, we'd be in.
But that doesn't sound good, but and it's funny because it's like I have a bunch of friends that we all have blue bubbles, and then you get that one person who has a Windows phone, just like, you're the worst.
What's wrong with you?
I know.
I'm leaving you off the thread. I got a friend, he switched to a dumb phone, can't even do group messaging, which I'm like, you know what? I'm almost okay with that, because now I don't feel obliged to add you to the list.
Why? They went backwards in time.
Yeah. Well, I know.
Did you explain to them that with a smartphone, you can do those things still? It's the dumb phone function still exists within the smartphone realm.
You know, I think he's just trying to eliminate distractions. So
that's cool. I get that, but...
Says the guy with a VR headset. No, you don't. Not at all.
Oh man, that was. You know, I will say this. I kind of forgot that I had it on my face until you just pointed it out. That's pretty good.
Wow, that says something too, right there. Interesting.
I know. So iMessages is kind of a big deal. I think what we'll see, it's going to be a. It kind of goes to the bigger question of, you know, why doesn't Apple build an iMessages for Android? Because that would be awesome. And I think that's a big part of the answer, is they recognize it. And unlike, you know, Google believed...
Remember back in the day when they promised they were going to open source it and launch it everywhere? Oh,
not iMessages. Days. It was FaceTime.
FaceTime, that's right. That's right. Yeah, my bad. You're right.
But Google, you know, when Google had, they had their Google Reader, which was an amazing tool, really great. Great example of Google being awesome. Just
cut that wound deep.
And then they, I'm going to say, and then they destroyed it because they felt that it was their best. They, as a platform, it was their best social network they had, and they were trying to push Google Plus. And so they took the team from Google Reader, brought them over to Google Plus, and ruined both.
You're just like twisting the knife.
I know. And I feel like Apple is looking at some iMessages right now and is like, don't kill it. Whatever you do, don't mess it up. Which,
what do you think about all their stickers and plugins and things like that?
They're fine.
Okay. I don't love
it. I think it's the minimum bar. There are other pieces of iMessages, like the previews for YouTube and articles, that are fantastic.
Mm.
That I really enjoy, especially because I use that as I and some of my friends use that as, like, we share a lot of articles that way. Okay. And so all of a sudden, instead of it just being links, it's actually like full context and stuff. You know, I think as long as Apple is keeping up with the minimum bar for parity with Facebook and Google and everybody else, they'll be fine. Okay.
I don't love having to flip through the stickers and stuff. It's a little clunky, but I don't know. I also don't know how you'd solve
it. Well, don't worry. They'll fix it in a year.
I'm sure they will.
You know, it's funny. I hear people whining about the new Apple Music interface and how horrible and unintuitive it is and how it went from being really great and usable to just terrible. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, it was terrible. It's so much better. But Apple made them. The Apple did what Apple does, which is they waited an entire year, so people became familiar with this unintuitive interface that was Apple Music, and they built a much better, more intuitive interface. And they did, instead of doing small iterative changes to the software over the course of a year, keeping people familiar with the familiar elements, they just made this giant jump and like lost users and. Their software strategy drives me crazy sometimes. But they seem to be keeping iMessages alive, so that's pretty good.
Yep.
But Facebook, they want to expand into a new area with their social network. And this week, workplace.fb.com or workplace for by Facebook, I think that's what they're calling it, went live today or this week.
Yeah, that's right. So HP uses, what's the one Microsoft bought them a while ago?
LinkedIn?
No. It's kind of like, sorry, what?
I don't know.
It's like Slack, but, okay, let's see here. Social network, I should have looked this up. Network bought by Microsoft. I think they would call them a social network. Yeah, not LinkedIn. I can't. That doesn't help me. let's see here. Key acquisitions. They've bought a lot. Holy cow. Let's see here. Where is 2016? Holy cow, they buy a lot of companies. They bought Sunrise. I remember that. Acompli. We're getting there. They had an office. Yammer. Thank you, Wikipedia. All right. So Microsoft has Yammer. Have you ever used it at all?
No. I've heard of it.
So it's think Facebook for work. This is kind of the idea for it, where you can post stuff. You've got a timeline, a wall. You can have profiles. You can have different groups. You can send messages within the groups or out to the entire company. You can broadcast live stuff. Sound familiar yet?
Yes.
You can add pictures, status updates, blah blah blah. You can do it all. HP has it, uses it. It's dumb. I don't know. I never use it. I signed up. I was like, cool, and then that was the extent of it. So. I don't know. Maybe it's part of it's just the company culture, but I don't get, like, anytime someone uses it, like, this feels really, really forced. And Maybe the hope is if we post all of our announcements, like they used to post all of our announcements on there. They did that for like 6 months, and now they're back to just emailing it out to everybody, which I think tells you how well that worked. I don't know. I don't get the use case for it, I guess. But
yeah, maybe it's
the culture of my company.
I was gonna suggest that you and I should get it because it's like $3 a month for each of us. But maybe we shouldn't get it. I don't know.
So workplace, we can do our workplace by Facebook. Workplace. I thought, won't we just use our existing social network to do all what we do?
But this is new.
Oh. Got it.
Yeah. Good call. Yeah, there's a big question here because it's like, you know, I'm a big believer that the idea that Facebook's value proposition and almost everything that they do is that they're a fantastic engineering company and they're not necessarily going to win. They're a little bit late to the game, especially since things like Slack and Yammer exist and they're all described as, you know, Facebook for work. So when Facebook
I actually like Slack. Something about them, like, oh, I would use that regularly.
Interesting. But the idea, the complicated part here in the question that everybody's asking is that all of these different work platforms, people have been describing them as, you know, Facebook for work for a long time. Now Facebook actually has a thing for work. And the question is this what everybody's been waiting for? Or is it way too late? Because are they now a Yammer clone? Are they now a Slack clone?
Slack, I think, is directly... Oh, geez, I don't know. Maybe it's just how you use it. Like, when I think about Facebook Messenger, I don't think I am. Whereas for Slack, I think instant messaging. And I don't use Yammer for instant messaging, but that's because they have Skype, which I use for instant messaging at work. I just don't know. I think, like, you think about calendars and contacts and email, and, like, they don't do any of that. Now, Slack's whole premise is because of them, you don't need email anymore. You would just write a message and send it to them in a big window, and you can add attachments and stuff. So, it doesn't feel like it's a Slack competitor. It feels like it's a Yammer competitor, despite what this article is claiming.
I don't really know any of them well enough to know the answer to that.
Yeah, you don't quite have a big enough office, huh?
Yeah, we can just, you know, go and talk to each other. That's amazing. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, which is one of those where it's like, yeah, you remember when we signed up for Slack, it was like, okay, cool, send a message.
Yeah, I was like, how is this better than iMessages? I don't get it.
I mean, we can send each other articles, really cool. I guess, but... It doesn't have document editing. It doesn't have... It's Yammer is what it is. It's like a pure social network. And I think in the workplace, it's more about collaboration.
Yeah.
And I don't see how what has been described with Facebook, which is Facebook. They're saying it's like it's Facebook, but for work, you're going, it doesn't enable collaboration as much as I would like. Whereas... clearly, Microsoft has figured that out, except for the Yammer piece. It's like, and it feels tacked on, to be honest. But everything else that they have, their OneDrive, their Skype, and, you know, even their individual apps, like, it's all about collaboration, which in a work environment, that's what matters, and that's what you're attempting to do. And I don't know. Slack is all about collaboration as well. And, yeah, Yammer is not. LinkedIn is not.
Yeah.
There's my
tirade. I'm really curious to see where this goes because I don't know enough.
It'll be fine. They'll have a ton of users. They'll make some money off of it. It'll be good. I don't know. They're not going to take over the world. I don't think I'll be really interested actually to see if HP does it. I doubt it because at one time they were headed on the track of like using Google Docs and getting into Google Drive. And then Microsoft came along and all of a sudden everything switched. Back 100% Microsoft.
Sweet like, talk, yeah.
All right, clearly someone at Microsoft caught the wind and made a deal happen here. And so I'd be shocked if we switch over to a Facebook something. Shocked, I tell you. But
yeah.
Anyways.
Interesting.
So just I guess quick-ish. So farming, apparently, I don't know if you know this, but eating meat is like one of the most inefficient ways to consume calories.
Yes, but it's one of the most delicious ways to do it.
I'm totally with you there. And so he goes through and he does some math. It's pretty funny where he talks about that he describes it. He says a chicken is one of the most efficient types of meat out there, but it requires 9 calories in the form of wheat or soy or whatever it is to get 1 calorie back out from the chicken. Okay?
Okay.
He goes, plus there's the consternation about food waste. He goes, and it happens, but there's about 40% of food that's produced, which is thrown away. Okay? So he's saying when we produce and eat chicken, we're effectively throwing away 800% of the food that's produced. Which I'm like, that math doesn't work, but okay, I get what your point is. They should do it in a fraction of food produced. Like you're not throwing away 40% of the food, you're actually throwing away like 90% of the food, but whatever.
Right.
Yeah, math is a little weird. Pork is 15 calories for 1 calorie. Beef is 23 to 25 calories for 1 calorie back out. Highly inefficient. But it's interesting that this guy goes on to say that we're going to create kind of a little bit of a problem here, where he gives a really good analogy, and I cannot think of it for the life of me, on essentially... Oh, yeah, I remember now. He talks about the horse and buggy whip thing and the transition to cars, where he was like, we had horse and buggies, and in New York, it was becoming an epidemic, huge, huge problem, right? Just manure everywhere was escalating to a point where people were like, this cannot be sustained. And what he's saying is that in the food industry, it's happening the exact same way. As more and more people are around and our desire to not have everyone starving increases, which is not the case right now, he says it's just going to be it is creating this exponential issue where we literally cannot physically create enough food to feed everybody, even if we wanted to. And so, I mean, like, the easy answer is to eat less meat and become a vegetarian. Primarily, he goes, that would solve the problem like almost overnight if we all did that. But you know, he fully recognizes, like you have said, that taste is important, and especially in America, meat is kind of a thing. I know some guys who are like if there's no meat at a meal, it's just a snack. It's not actually a meal. That's a requirement of it. So I get it. So this guy, Bruce Frederick, he believes that the solution is going to come from technological improvements, and specifically, think of it like cultured meat. And so he talks about, he says, says he tasted cultured meat from this one company called Memphis Meats. He goes, and it tastes exactly like conventional created meat. He goes, and that makes sense, since the point of clean meat is that it is the exact same thing. There's no difference, so there's no difference in taste either. And when he asked about the price of it, he goes, well, it's not quite competitive yet. But he truly believes that in the next 5 to 10 years it will be. And what's really interesting, too, is he starts asking him questions, too, about, well, how are people going to feel about eating meat made in a lab? He goes, well, at the end of the day, Cheerios were created in a lab, and now they're created in a factory, and we seem to have gotten over it. He goes, meat, yes, today is in a lab, but eventually will be in a factory. He goes, and if it tastes good and the price is right, just like Cheerios, people are going to get over it.
Yeah, that's the answer. I mean, it's, you know, it's, I don't know, there is this weird question of it, like, we build these super efficient individual factories for growing meat called animals. how much more efficient can we do? You know, there's a trade-off to do it more efficiently than animals do it already, which is about as efficiently as they can do it. I mean, that's their primary goal in being alive. don't waste energy. So I don't know. It's an interesting conversation. I do think that there's something to be said for the idea culturally of like embracing that, you know, most of human history has been spent not eating as much meat as Americans eat. And there's probably something to a healthier diet that is balanced differently, but I don't know, you can't necessarily fix that. there's a whole problem of freedom. Yeah. So maybe. Well,
and that's why he's saying we're not going to create laws for that. He goes, the best solution is one where you don't have to create a law, where people just genuinely want that more. And
yeah, that's true.
That's where they're headed. I'm like, I get that. But he thinks like 10 years. So 2026.
Cheerios were not made in a lab. Cheerios were made in like the 1900s. They were made in a kitchen.
Whatever, which is a analogy. fancy type of a lab.
It's a very specific lab environment.
Like McDonald's, right? They have a lab. So every single new thing that they come out with, they developed in a lab.
Yeah.
And that's what they're proud of. They're like, yeah, we've got all these full-time chefs, and they're awesome, and they create food ideas, and we have very specific specs. Like, you have to be able to eat it in a car.
Yeah.
It has to be delicious. So, mm-hmm. I get it. Anyways. Food tech, it's happening.
Yeah. So we're running out of time, so I'll run through this really quickly. Because I think this story is coming towards a close, so this will be our last Samsung exploding phone update. So Samsung, they've announced this week that they've completely halted production. They will never return production of the Note 7. The Note 7 is dunskies. They have gone so far as to announced that they are going to dispose of all Note 7s. They haven't said exactly what that's going to look like, where they're going to dispose it, and there's a lot of environmental organizations that are like, you'd better not just dump a whole bunch of phones in a landfills. So, which I'm sure Samsung's like... Yeah, they cannot
catch a break. They're like, we're going to dispose of them. What?
Yeah. Which I'm sure Samsung's like, look, we're obviously not going to just throw them away. Like, most of these things are brand new with all sorts of, like, reusable materials in them. Especially since... And this is a big thing.
It sounds thing for them.
I don't know. Especially since it sounds like at this point, the problem isn't actually the battery, which is interesting. Huh. Because everybody's been talking about how they're exploding batteries. And you're like, what is going on? Well, it turns out that when they decided to, quote-unquote, fix the phones and sell replacement phones, they were blaming one of their suppliers for selling faulty batteries. Well, obviously they kept exploding. And so now they've had to take a step back and said, well, we know that the batteries we're getting aren't faulty, which leads us to one really frustrating conclusion, which is that the problem isn't the phones.
Yeah, or the batteries. Yeah.
isn't the batteries. But it has also led them to the conclusion that they don't actually know what's wrong with them. There's all sorts of fun little things going on. Like, there was an email sent out to all of the engineers that basically saying, do not email, do not text message, do not talk about this issue at all online, ever. Talk about it with people face-to-face, because now they're in, like, deep into the woods of worries of lawsuits and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't want anything that can be brought into a courtroom. So, yes, they're just openly telling their employees, yeah, don't write anything down. Just talk in person.
Wow.
I know.
I saw an estimate somewhere where they expect to lose like $3 billion in net profit as a result of this.
Yeah, sounds about right.
That's not a small number. And I'm happy to report that they listened to this podcast, took my advice. They are now officially banned from U.S. flights. So
I know. Which is...
took them long enough.
Talk about a PR disaster. That has just been a...
we will confiscate your Note 7. Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, you are as bad as a terrorist. Wait a second. Yes.
Well, you know, you're literally carrying a bomb on the plane.
It's bad news.
I get it. Oh, yeah. Incredible.
When I was reading a an article that was talking about this, and they were like, and there, that was their comment. There was like, well, you know, technically, bombs have already been illegal on planes, so is it really that surprising that Samsung's phones are now? But the I don't want to beat up too much because
thermonuclear on them, huh? Jeez.
Yeah, I know, right?
Poor guys.
I know. Mac Daily News, every article about Samsung, they're like, this is what happens when karma comes back to get you.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, they would have a feeling with it. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, the Note 8 is going to be an interesting beast. I got to give it another name. I'd be shocked if they come out with another Note phone. I would just name it something totally different and walk away from that line. It could be the exact same, like, it could be the Note 8, but I would call it the not-so-Note 8. Something.
Yeah. Well, and, yeah. Yeah. They got a weird PR challenge ahead of them. How do you recoup your brand after this? Because they did a lot of damage to their brand. Yeah. But it will be fun to watch for that specific reason, because, you know, it's one of the most valuable companies on Earth. They've got the largest number of, you know, cell phones out there. If anybody can hire a super high-powered PR team to recoup their image, it's Samsung. And they will spend the money to do that.
And so they make enough
money. It'll be really interesting to see how do you.
Yeah, and they make enough money from their other companies or business stuff that they can weather it. It's not a problem. And so they could just keep going. You know that, you know what I mean? They're not going to implode like a BlackBerry type of thing. So
right. Yeah. Well, and
or even an LG or someone else, right? They can stand it. Something to be said about diversification. Right.
And credit where credit's due, because the other side of one of the other sides of their company, their chip company, they've announced they just developed a new system on a chip for smartwatches that has a built-in LTE modem. And it's super small and can fit into the package of like modern smartwatches and stuff. And so they're going to be pushing LTE connected smartwatches now. And, you know, and that was a built here Samsung product. It's pretty cool sounding. And I'm kind of like, that's what I've been saying I want. So I hope it might be a Samsung built chip that Apple puts into their Apple Watch.
Dang. Just real quick, because we're going to talk a lot more of this later, I'm sure. Snapchat, they're getting ready to do their IPO. Sounds like in March. They want to be worth $25 billion is kind of the initial thought. It sounds way too early to me. I don't know, man. I think it's a mistake, if you will. It's definitely counter-trend, let's put it that way, to be going public as early as they are. But that's what they're doing. And everyone's like, oh, it's going to be the biggest since Twitter. So I'm like, oh, yeah. Keep those comparisons going.
Yeah, the biggest since Twitter. That's see how that turned out.
Yeah,
because you pointed this out that like Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg would have kept Facebook private for the rest of his life if he could have figured out how to do it.
Yep.
But he had to pay back his early investors, and that's how he did it. Was through
we're an IPO. Only allowed a certain number of shareholders before you have to go public, and they hit that ceiling, and yeah, and so they literally, in order to keep growing, they had to go public.
Well, and we've talked about how they set their IPO price at a ridiculous high. They IPO'd and then plummeted, which is not normally what you do in an IPO, but everybody knew that was going to happen because the early investors were cashing out. I mean, that was their deal. This was the payoff for investing in Facebook when it was young, was this enormously high IPO. They didn't have to wait a year for the price to reach $80 a share. It started there. And so, yes, it plummeted. And then it slowly rebuilt and passed that number. You look at, man, Evan Spiegel and company. Like, why are they doing this? What are they doing?
I don't know. Pure ego. Surprise, surprise.
You think so? You don't think they're...
One too many selfies.
Yeah, right. Do you don't think that they have a legitimate use to raise capital to expand their platform so they can become a dominant
Yeah, they got to start
in the market.
Sunglasses.
I know. That's the part that gets me is it's like, generally speaking, you go public to raise capital.
Or to pay back investors, but yes.
Or to pay back investors. And I don't get the company, man. I'm looking forward to hearing more about this as time goes on, because I feel like...
At the end of the day, there's been no company that says, man, I'm really glad we went public and now have to open our books and be scrutinized by investors.
Yeah.
No company's ever said that.
Yeah. But Evan Spiegel doesn't seem like the sort of guy who thinks that way.
I know. He's a genius or something. But
I do think that one of the things that he gets by IPOing is that his stock has actual open market value. He suddenly becomes super rich. Like the company's worth how much? It's valued at billions of dollars. He owns X amount of that stock. But if you can't sell it, if you can't sell that stock, then is it really worth that much? Whereas right now, what's his name? Mark Zuckerberg can just sell stock, Facebook stock, and he gets that cash.
Yeah.
And so banks will loan against it because they're like, well, it's worth actual money right now. It's just tied up in the stock. And whereas Evan Spiegel is limited because in a pre-IPO company, you can't just do that. You can't just sell your portion. You can't sell individual. You can't sell, $100,000 worth of stock and go buy a Ferrari. It's way more complicated to do that. And I wonder, I don't know. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all. That's all I got, James.
Sweet. Well, everybody, thanks for joining us. We really do appreciate it. And thanks for listening to episode 264. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes at furloughbros.com. Again, this will be episode 264. And if you'd like to get the show notes sent directly to you, if you go to furloughbros.com, you can sign up right there and we'll just email them to you. It's easy. And then finally, this podcast is supported by listeners just like you. And we have four different ways that you can contribute as a listener. There are fanboys, nerds, junkies, and mavens. And they each have their own different levels of rewards. Pretty awesome. Again, furloughbros.com. You can check out all the details for that. Let's see here. I am James Furlough, and my Sony PlayStation virtual VR wielding goggles brother is Matthew Furlough. And so we will talk next time.